Hello, yeah.
When the green light comes on, I'm recording, and I'm gonna bump that up because I don't think I'm getting quite enough volume. Okay.
Okay.
So this is what I need, Brian. Is I need
Scott.
I'm so sorry. At this point, we've got a lot of really great stories that tell a very vivid, exciting story. And so what we are looking for is drama. We're looking for concrete images so that the reader... We do not want this to the a reader to pick up this book, flip it to any page, and think, ugh, this is dull, and put it down. And I've... unfortunately, at the beginning of the collection of these stories, I got a lot of stories like that. But I've gotten better as time has gone by, and we've weeded out a few, but we want to keep yours in, and we want you to tell your story as sexy as possible. Just in a word. I mean, you know, stories are now considered sexy or not sexy, so, I mean, you don't have to make anything up. And also, be assured that before this story goes even to stand for review, it goes to you. So that you will have an opportunity to review it.
Oh, no problem.
Okay.
No problem.
Just, well, that's a courtesy that usually is not extended.
No.
And I just want you to know that. And, you know, that water's starting to look good to me.
Let me get you one.
Thanks. Thank you.
Oh,
good color.
Yeah. Well, I'll just start at the beginning.
All right.
In 1989, I was a young, somewhat young, attorney, and one of my clients was the city of Cordova. And it had been my practice, under my supervisor's direction and the city council's direction, to fly over, you know, periodically for meetings or as needed to advise and represent the city. And I felt it a distinct honor and privilege to do that.
Sure.
Because the firm I worked for had been the city's attorney since the early 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
When the city and its people went through a, including going through the Good Friday earthquake.
Okay.
And the weekend of Exxon Valdez, I was in Anchorage when it happened. I heard about it instantly from the city manager, Don Moore, of Cordova at that time. And the next day, I flew over to Cordova in a small plane piloted by Jeff Roth, who was one of the lawyers in our firm. And as we flew over Prince William Sound, the Coast Guard cutter Mustang was making her way toward Exxon Valdez. And I looked down. We were flying pretty low. And it was a beautiful, clear day. And I looked down and I saw Mustang, a vessel that I was familiar with because I'd lived on Kodiak, where she was home ported at the time. Had been for many years. And I looked down and in the distance I could see Exxon Valdez, hard aground on Bly Reef. And I looked at the sound, and the Mustang was cutting. She was operating at full speed ahead, and she was cutting a wake of brown, frothy brown water. It was just the ugliest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I just gasped. I just went, oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Because we were still normally when you fly over to Cordova, you know, you're not gonna fly right over Bly Reef or that close to Valdez Arm, but so I was kind of in a state of shock. I think, you know, like with a lot of other folks. And we got to Cordova and we landed at the EAC airstrip, which is the old city airport,
right,
close to town. landed on skis. We were still on skis at that time. And I didn't leave the town, I think, for 5 or 6 weeks after. I ended up staying in a closet somewhere, or in different places. The city council was meeting in more or less continuous emergency session. There were endless meetings, endless conferences. Political aspects of the spill were enormous, not to mention everything else. And therefore, there were a lot of politicians, staff, lawyers, you name it. Not to mention Exxon itself and Alyeska, which deployed enormous numbers of people everywhere. But one of the most vivid images for me was the night that the city council met and voted to spend the money to buy the spill equipment for the hatcheries. And taking a complete chance because, frankly, the state and federal governments were doing nothing, and Exxon was doing nothing, and Alyeska was doing nothing. And the decision was made to expend public funds to protect the hatcheries, which underscored several things, I think. One was the absolute relationship, symbiotic relationship between Cordova and fish. And fishing. And another was that the people closest to the spill, who lived there, whose lives were centered there, who cared most about what happened, were the people most willing to put their own lives and their own money and their own bodies on the line. Another vivid image I recall was Tom Copeland. Oh, you probably interviewed Tom or Will. Now, someone who can tell a good story is Tom.
I got Tom's story.
but Tom, I remember being down and talking with Tom, and he said, well, I'm going to go out there and just scoop up oil with buckets because they're not doing anything. And I thought that was admirable, but more vivid was when he came back. I mean, he came back with buckets of oil and smeared with the stuff. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, this is what we're doing. We're scooping up a super tanker with Zodiacs and buckets. Another vivid image was Kelly Weaverling, who I admire greatly. And I thought he exercised great leadership of a moral kind. I also thought that many people who otherwise aren't well known or active in politics or anything like that behaved admirably and altruistically and selflessly to help their neighbors and to help their friends, to help the people and the creatures and everybody else. Being the city attorney was probably, you know, one of the most dramatic and compelling things I'll ever be involved in, I would think. Certainly, looking back on it now, I realize that it was not just an extraordinary event, but it was a historical event.
Yes.
And you, when you're at the center of things, you know, Cordova was in a painful position. Because we weren't directly being oiled, but the economic impact was enormous. And the psychological impact was severe. I mean, truly, truly severe.
Mm-hmm.
It created and caused and exacerbated divisions and animosities in the town that, you know, were bitter and cost a lot of time and money over time. People. Another person that I hadn't really known before the spill but got to know very well was Marilyn Leland.
Yes.
Who I thought was amazing in terms of her energy and her common sense, her leadership. Same for Michelle O'Leary, another person who, when it got around to Open 90, probably was the single most effective voice of Prince William Sound in the Congress. Okay. So that bill probably should have her name on it, actually.
Well, I've got an interview.
Although many people contributed, and I played a little bit of a part in it, but in the city, but Michelle and RJ and some people like that. I just ran into RJ in Palmer, and we had a great reunion.
I just was at his house a few weeks ago. I love that house.
The house is amazing.
I love that house.
Yeah, no, I know. It's an amazing place. No, he's quite a guy.
Oh, yeah. So tell me what a day in the life of the attorney for the city of Cordova was like at that time. You had an office in Cordova.
Well, I operated out of City Hall. We had the first thing we did, well, not maybe the first thing, but real close in time, was create the Oil Spill Response Committee. And we hired Mead to be our coordinator, and later Tim Robinson took that job.
Mm-hmm.
Again, two also very amazing people.
Got their stories.
That I was really, glad to know and work with.
Right.
And I can only hope they say the same about me. I don't know. But we'll have to see how these stories come out. But
well, they haven't said anything bad about you.
Well, they must not know me. It was thought that, and I was in on this pretty heavily, it was thought that we need a community-based response, coordinated response, under the aegis of the city, so there's some legal structure and some political structure to it that would give the town a voice in what was happening and give it a role. And these things morphed eventually into the oiled mayors and sort of the political action that took place. And so for a while it worked. And it was, I think, in the sort of immediate shock period, that kind of summer afterwards, it was a good thing, and it did a lot of good. But it ran its life, eventually. Typical day for me probably would have been pretty long, like everyone else. I would have been up early. Most of my time would have been spent with the members of the city council and the city manager and other city personnel. Dewey Wetzel, another extraordinary individual. Cordova's like this, amazing small place that is overflowing with amazing people, that just walking down the street you might meet five PhDs who are doing things like fishing or some kind of community-based project. It's an extraordinary place. It really is.
I grew up next door to and went all the way through all the schools with Bobby Van Brocklin.
Well, there you go. So you know what I'm talking
about.
Yeah. Another person who I really liked. but that would be a typical day for me. I would spend a lot of time phoning and faxing. Didn't have that many cell phones back then, I don't think. Juneau, Washington, D.C., Valdez, in terms of Exxon, and then the local Exxon people, meetings with them, and then public meetings and trying to implement what the council wanted done. City attorney's job is to give sound advice and representation, and in a crisis it even becomes a little more acute because you kind of operate on unfamiliar ground. But of all the entities involved, the city was the only one with legal power to take extraordinary measures that could be enforced. So we looked very carefully at those things, and we bind the spill buoys, or not the buoys, but the containment. I'm losing track of the word.
That's okay. You'll have an opportunity to put it in later.
Stan will probably marvel that I can't remember
this. No, because you get it before Stan gets,
But anyway, all these things would come together. And then there would be frequent meetings. Mira Kohler, Bobby, Mead, myself, Don Moore, Marilyn, Connie Taylor, RJ, all these folks would be heavily involved. And I don't know if you know Richard Harding, the elder, the Reverend Harding.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, his son now, I think, has his congregation. But Reverend Harding was one of those people who, like an unsung hero, provided a lot of spiritual and comfort and counsel to people, and never got much recognition for it. But he was tireless. And then I would spend a lot of time just trying to help the city manager tackle practical issues. Where are we going to put spill workers? Where are we going to house them? How are we going to feed them? How are we going to make sure they have what they need? Who's going to pay? How are we going to adjust all this? All these things are just coming down in an endless stream of crises.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that are the macro issues of the claims that are going to come from this.
Right.
What's going to become of the fishing industry? How is this going to play out? What kind of legislation are we going to get out of this?
Was there any precedent that you could turn to?
You know, we looked. There are precedents for how to respond in crises. Like, you know, cities throughout the country and the world have had to deal with flash floods and earthquakes and you know, railroad disasters and coal mine disasters and things like that. So there are some precedents. But I think this one hit hard because it was a technological man-made disaster, number one. And because, as David Grimes and Rick and those guys would, you know, point out frequently and correctly, this hits us in the guts because it's us. It's us, it's our dependence, it's our consumption, it's our habits, it's our economy. This is the guck that we all need to thrive in our economy. And now it's being plastered all over our faces and our animals and our land and our water and our livelihoods. And boy, have the crows come home to roost. And Rick Steiner and David, I just, for me anyway, were this, like, the moral lodestars in this whole thing. If I ever thought I was drifting, or, you know, sometimes my own opinions, you know, when you're an attorney, your opinions are subordinate to your client's interests. But quite often I felt like, well, you know, I need to keep my head here because I'm not going to be a very good lawyer if I don't exercise leadership in a calm way. But by the same token, I would get very upset, you know, very upset about it. And those two gentlemen, and Ricky also, when we think about it, and Stan, eventually, when we got to know each other, we're all people who I just thought had their finger on the moral guiding light here, and that we need to be clear-headed about why we all share some responsibility for this. You know, and so it becomes a metaphor, and it becomes symbolic, and it becomes philosophical, and it becomes a life lesson, you know, on an individual and group level. And I was very grateful for those people having the wisdom that they did. Because when you're in a crisis, it's pretty easy just to spend all your time reacting, and you don't even have time to think, you know. And someone like David would think, and then he would tell you what he was thinking. Right. And he's such a gentleman, you know.
I have yet to meet him, but I am hopeful of getting in. He's in Europe right now.
I sincerely hope you can spend a lot of time with David.
Yeah.
And then Jonathan Wills, too. I hope you can spend time with Jonathan, too, because that would be worth your while.
He's back in Europe, correct? Or
in Shetland.
Yeah. I'll have to see if there's a possibility that we can do that somehow.
I would recommend that. And then the other person who I've already reeled off an incredible list, right? And there's a lot more, but you can't even begin to talk about Exxon Valdez without talking about Dan Lawn.
Oh, yeah.
And Dan Lawn is the most single-handedly responsible person for whatever good and whatever reforms and whatever consciousness and awareness and prevention ever comes from this thing is to his credit.
Yeah, we've got a lot.
Absolutely.
On Dan.
And I am one of those people that Dan will tell you and everyone else will tell you that having been in the trenches with Dan, you know, not an easy guy to get along with, right? Whether you're a friend or foe.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
What's in my pocket? Hello? You know what? You caught me in the middle of another interview, Salen, and when I told you that I was 10 minutes away from you, I was calling the last person. I thought that... Sorry. Okay, I'll call you later. Okay, thanks. Bye. My third child. One of the stragglers my son brought home one day, and now we can't get rid of him, nor do we want to.
Right. In fact, I should turn this off, too, because this thing goes off all the time. I think that Dan is the Diogenes of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he made people uncomfortable because he just uncompromisingly sticks to the truth.
Right.
That doesn't mean he's fault-free or can't make mistakes. But I think that as much as it was painful at the time, and as angry as I would sometimes get in fighting with Dan over this or that, I look back on it now and I'm grateful to him for being truthful and honest at all times.
We're having a, I don't know if I should put this on the record or not. In fact, I think I'll just turn this up.